plans, your secret when you left your office last night and you closed the door behind you. Were you walking in your sleep or were you just too tired to notice all the watchful eyes upon you?
Tom Esther. And this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Esker, here in the heartland, in the bunker, right here in North.
It's a great day for singing a song, and it's a great day for moving along. Terrible Tommy here, and it's 10/10/2017 on a bright, sunny, fiery day in California. Fires all over the place. No fires around here, but that's the people got some big bad troubles. Lots of people dying in the fire. A lot of people that won't leave their property, and that's sort of typical of mankind. They're sort of greedy, and they don't want to leave go of what they got. Now, I don't blame them in a way, but when they allow themselves to get burnt up over property, that's a sort of Jewish, if you ask me. Most of the fires are farther up north, way up north. Had a couple down here, but not much. Well, I see the alt-right's at it again. They had a little get-together down there in Charlottesville. article brought my attention, was brought to my attention. And let's see, where's it at down here? See if I can put my specs on, see if I can read it. I thought it was quite interesting. What was really interesting was the fact that nobody counterattacked them and so forth and so on, because they did the smart thing. And maybe they, I don't know, maybe they're listening to me or some of you guys, but they didn't announce that they're going to do it ahead of time, which I've said before is the way you do it. If they're going to be local demonstrators, well, okay, you know. But most local demonstrators aren't violent. When you announce what you're going to do it, you know, to get press and all that kind of stuff, you get the wrong kind of press. These creeps come from all over the place. Yeah. So they did the right thing here, and nobody had any bad press on them except your dirty, rotten, racist bastards. Like they always do. Where is that in this article here? After news of Saturday's rally spread, counter-protesters gathered outside the residence of the UVA president, Teresa Sullivan. You see, when it's held spontaneously like that on quick notice, the demonstrators, even the ones that are there, they've only got really, they can only mass their forces against somebody in the system, not you. So they were chanting, no cops, no KKK, no fascist UVA. So the brunt of their attack in Charlottesville this weekend was the university. By contrast, thousands of counter-protesters showed up in August because that rally had been promoted ahead of the event. Charlottesville Mayor Mike Siner blasted Saturday's gathering. Of course, they always do that, as despicable. It is despicable. Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe, a Democrat, condemned these racists. City Councilman Wes Bellamy called for felony intimidation charges against the participants. You see, that part of it don't matter. That's, in fact, that's good, you see. But the fact that they couldn't say that the right, so-called right-wing racial nationalists didn't start a riot, because it takes Bolsheviks to have a riot. And where did it say? Charlottesville police said in a statement that there was no violence and that the group left the city by bus immediately after the rally ended. Miriam Dickler, a spokesman for the city, told the local Daily Progress that such protests are protected by the First Amendment, unless we perceive a legal and safety issue, which there wasn't. So Spencer, who was the head right-wing guy, he said, it worked out real good. Well, he should have done that the first time. So whether they borrowed that idea from us, or you, or me, or somebody else, it doesn't make any difference. It turned out okay. Even though I don't see the need for these rallies like there used to be. But at least if you spontaneously have them, even though they're smaller, local demonstrators usually don't get violent unless you're in Chicago or New York or someplace like that. But in a relatively moderate-sized city, the people who turn out to demonstrate against you are not going to be violent, or not many going to be violent. So, and still you get some press. You don't have to get nationwide, worldwide press. In fact, if you're going to get really bad press, like people being run over by cars, That's not good press at all. If the press show up and there's nobody trying to kill somebody, they're not even going to be that interested in writing a big anti-racial story. See how it works? You got to think before you do these things. You got to think while you're doing them, and you got to think after you've done them. Anyhow, it was a rally. They had a tiki torch lit 10-minute rally Saturday night that drew 40 to 50 people who listened to fiery speeches, sang Dixie, and shouted slogans such as "The South will rise again." Well, you maybe better be worried about now the U.S. rising again. Not in the South. The U.S. got to rise quite a bit. And I don't think you'd want the Southern agrarian plantation capitalists to rise again. They just bring more Negroes into the South. They were prepared after the war not to get rid of the so-called slaves and blacks, but to bring more in. You know, I came across a letter that was from the Oceanside riot that we talked about last week in 1980. And this letter was from a regular working class white person that gave it to me. I tried to give it to the Oceanside City Council, and they said because there's no name at the bottom, they wouldn't accept it. Well, the reason there's no name at the bottom was the person feared for his life, not from the KKK, but from the Progressive Labor Party, the communist organization. Anyhow, here's the letter. On March 15th, I was across from John Landis Park watching the different demonstrations taking place against the KKK. I was extremely amazed that the protesters were allowed to walk the streets chanting and yelling their chants. I could not believe that the city council of Oceanside could blindly revoke the Klan's permit to be inside the building at John Landis Park, and yet the protesters parade the city streets without a parade permit. It was obvious to myself and the people around me that the protesters were there for more than just a protest against the Klan. Upon seeing the Klan move down the street towards the park, the protesters seemed to get a burst of energy, running from one place to another, awaiting the arrival of the Klan at the park. The Klan arrived at the park and began their meet with music and speeches. There were no threatening motions toward violence from the Klan. They had arrived peacefully and were conducting themselves in a peaceful manner. As the Klan turned to leave, they walked towards the west end of the park first, then turned south towards the buildings in the park. At that time, I noticed several of the people protesting against the Klan throwing items into their group. By the time the Klan had reached the building where the police were gathered outside, or inside, the crowd had become crazed with anger and began again throwing large items such as beer bottles, pop cans, and so forth. I could not believe that the police, just inside the building and only a few feet away, did nothing to control the conditions present. Instead, they allowed this crowd to follow the Klan down the street, waiting until they, the Klan, were at least a block away before they even showed themselves outside the building. Allowing that kind of danger to proceed down the street into a neighborhood and into private property without even an attempt to stop the crowd, just separate the two, the Klan and the protesters. I voiced my opposition to City Manager Brossier prior to the meeting that took place when I found out that the city had revoked the permit. As far as communication problems that the police say they had, I was standing next to a motorcycle policeman when they said an announcement of unlawful assembly was going to be called. It was a good 15 or 20 minutes before the helicopter could even be heard making some kind of announcement. Maybe the announcement should have come from the police cars with loudspeakers. You could not hear the announcement being made from the helicopter because of the noise of the copter itself. Perhaps the city council should have its meeting permits revoked until we can elect a city council not so concerned with their own images as the citizens' rights for protection. The permit to use the building should never have been revoked. At least the control of the situation would have been easily taken over by the police, if necessary, instead of having the mob of these foolish people running the neighborhood in which I live, threatening lives of innocent people. Or perhaps have we allowed our city to be taken over by groups of troublemakers from places like L.A. and San Diego and other places in California? Above party's letter was not read at the city council meeting due to lack of identification of the writer. Signed, writer fearing reprisals. So that's the way it goes. I think the one thing that the alt-right people, if they honestly felt this way, really made a big error in Charlottesville, because when you give these people on the left time and a place, you're setting yourself up before you even get started, because it gives them sometimes weeks to get their forces together, even travel clear across country to get there to cause trouble. So, in a sense, the alt-right caused their own problem. But it looks like maybe they're going to rectify that now, so we'll see what happens at the next rally. But I recommend that you stay away from rallies. You know, there's a thriving business in this country that's gone on for a long time, and I've watched it grow, and I've watched it collapse, and I've watched it rise again. It's called revisionism. Yeah, you got revisionism on the so-called left, and you got revisionism on the so-called right. And there's starting to be some new revisionism, not totally new, but about Stalin, and they're going at each other, pro and con, all over the place. And so a lot of this stuff is sent to me, and I get to read it. But I have a different feeling about it than most people. So I sent this out to a bunch of people that were on the list that sent stuff to me. I escaped Hitler revisionism a long time ago, and I really don't want to get into Stalin revisionism. The bottom line is both were complicit in the annihilation of millions of white people and others. Actually, Hitler more than Stalin during the Second World War. Before and after, it was more Stalin, but during the war, it was more Hitler. The facts are Stalin did not want a war and nearly had a mental breakdown when Hitler attacked in Barbarossa. All that right-wing bullshit that Stalin was preparing to attack Germany and Europe is just so much nonsense and can be proven. 50,000 German engineers a year were working in Russia at the time. The Russian military were working directly with the German government and not the Communist Party and with Germany. Doesn't sound to me like a country is getting prepared to invade another country. Germany was investing millions of marks into Russia. Just a minute. Just a minute, boys and girls. I've lost my place. Oh, here we go. In short, Barbarossa was insane and may very well have begun the end of white Western civilization due to linkage. It's my personal belief that Hitler's doctor had him on a weird concoction, including meth. Both Hitler worship and Stalin worship is anti-white or anti-Aryan, if you know all the facts and you're not misled. What greater lie could the Jews create than this lie that's been floating around Hitler worship and Stalin worship. The U.S. military-industrial complex and their banker buddies even now continue to defamed Russia, signed Tom Metzger. Incidentally, the other day I got an email from somebody that said that Dennis Mahan had been shipped out. As usual, I got interrupted there for a little bit. Honeydew stuff. Anyhow, I got an email from someone that said Dennis Mahan had been transferred to another prison, which he's been anticipating getting closer to his home in Illinois. But I went to the Federal Register. That's what you always should do, is go to the Federal Prison, BOP Prison Register, and check. Well, he's still at Hazleton. Where was that? Hazleton, West Virginia, I think it was. He's still 67 years old. He's still white, and he's still male. Tells me he's got a new job doing a lot of mopping and sweeping, gets $18 a month for it. So he's real happy when we send him down there, $25 a month. He's really happy to get it. Well, we've almost got this book on U.S. riots completed, so I do want to work at it more, a couple of more chapters at least. This is a police strike in Boston, September 9th to the 12th, 1919. Invitation to lawlessness. At the routine 5:45 roll call following the Monday shift on Tuesday, September 9, 1919, slightly more than 1,100 of the 1,450 patrolmen on the Boston police force answered "not present" when their names were called. They turned in their badges, revolvers, and billy clubs and locker keys to the precinct captains and walked out of the 19th District Station houses throughout the city. The name of each departing patrolman was noted on the roster as absent without leave. The policemen in the hub of the hub were going out on strike. This exodus, not at all unforeseen, was an almost open invitation to mischief, thievery, and every sort of crime, mainly by Negroes. I added that. The 750,000 citizens of Boston lacked the basis of all city police protection and everyday security of the cop on the beat. No major American metropolis had ever before been so unprotected. The strike was no surprise, for all citizens were familiar with the grievances of the patrolmen. The pay was low at a time when the wartime economy was booming. Station houses were run down, unsanitary, and crowded. Promotion was based on favoritism rather than the merit or civil service examinations. The pension scheme was woefully inadequate. The policemen had reached the end of their patience. Police Commissioner Edwin Curtis, an aristocrat and former mayor of Boston, considered them nagging troublemakers, like they do all white workers. And the cops are white workers, too. To him, their protests represented rebellion against the ruling class. Feeling that an alliance with the American Federation of Labor would aid them in pressing their demands, the patrolmen had already formed a union local and elected 8 officers in mid-August. Commissioner Curtis belatedly forbade his men to join, tried the union officers for disobedience, and since he was the sole judge, found them guilty. He then filed charges against 11 other leaders. All sentences were to be announced on September 4th. The union immediately threatened a strike if the 19 were discharged from the force. As middleman, Mayor Andrew Peters set up a committee of citizens to arbitrate the dispute. Their appeal to Governor Calvin Coolidge, who had been appointed Curtis to interfere, was abruptly refused. On Monday afternoon, September 8th, the commissioner suspended the 19 men for disobeying his order, and the night the union members unanimously voted to strike on the next afternoon. Bostonians spent Tuesday frantically preparing for the unknown future. Stores, business firms, and banks organized special protective forces. Several hundred citizen volunteers, including the entire Harvard football team, were deputized as police. Hold it. Police force of 100 was called for special city duty. The city awaited the fateful hour. At three of the 19 stations, the entire force walked out. The average number leaving the others was 90%. Word of the walkout spread rapidly to the haunts of the lawless throughout the city. Whoa, I wonder who that was. This was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Thousands of shops and businesses were unprotected. Only plate glass windows separated the displayed goods from those who wished to possess them. The selection was endless, since prices were at an all-time war level, making the resale price high. Even undreamed of luxuries were within reach. Now, you see, in any breakdown, this is what's going to happen. Because the police are just going to be worrying about saving themselves and their families. And the rabble will go crazy in the cities, especially in the cities. And maybe by then they'll even have all the guns taken away from the people. Juvenile troublemakers were the first to test the situation in outbreaks of vandalism, such as pulling trolleys from their overhead wires and smashing car windows. When no policemen arrived, they grew bolder and more destructive, stealing automobiles, stripping, and then abandoning them. They piled boxes on streetcar tracks and stoned passengers fleeing from the slow cars. They turned in scores of false fire alarms. It was all great fun. The small number of available non-striking policemen and officers remained in various station houses with the members of the Metropolitan Park Police Force. These men had been assigned to the stations from which the largest number of patrolmen had walked out. The volunteer enrollees were on call. No policeman was to venture out on the streets unless there was serious emergency. Not a single patrolman was walking his beat. The way was now clear for more full-scale lawlessness, which erupted almost simultaneously in two widely separated sections of the city. Near the downtown business area, ruffians had been collecting in Scully Square, an area of honky-tonks, cheap bars, burlesque, and all-night movie theaters, flop houses, penny arcades, and shooting galleries. Just a place I'd like to hang out. Ah, wait a minute. School A Square was within a block of the courthouse police station, where only 10 of the normal force of 129 were on duty. And almost within the shadow of the city hall and the central police headquarters. Minute by minute, the square had filled up. By 10:30 p.m., about 5,000 people had collected there, milling around as if waiting for someone and some act to send them into action. Late in the evening, a roaming gang of boys swept into the nearby burlesque theater and stopped the performance with their yelling and shouting, before being thrown out by the bouncers. This group joined a large number of idlers, immediately began smashing the plate glass windows of the adjoining shoe store. A few boys calmly stepped through, then began handing out shoes in the display, clearing the shelves of their boxes. This successful and effortless robbery was a spark that ignited the flame of wild and wanton destruction and plunder. Nearby, all along Hanover Street, an ever-swelling, jubilant crowd smashed store windows, loading their arms with shoes, haberdasheries, and clothing. Turning on Washington Street, this group moved rapidly towards Wholesale Market District, storming the many stores in the vicinity, loading themselves with every kind of fruit and vegetable as they swept simultaneously along the street. They dispersed only when the watchman of the warehouse stood them off for 20 minutes by calmly aiming his 38 revolver and daring any one of these number to advance. I see, there you go. One guy with a 38 caliber gun held off many, many dozen rioters. At Haymarket Square, these first rioters found others ready and eager to unite with them. At the cry, "Come on!" they accomplished their first large-scale looting by cleaning out the stocks of both cigar and clothing store. But soon, six police sergeants arrived, charged with revolvers and momentarily scattered them. The thrill of vandalism had seized and invigorated the mob. They were intoxicated by their success. Sizable crowds now covered all the crooked streets and narrow alleys in the older section of Boston. The small units of police and volunteers dispatched from time to time could only play a game of hide-and-seek in the maze of streets. When they met a group and sent them on the run, the determined rioters merely reassembled elsewhere. Plundering crowds were soon operating everywhere throughout the area. Oblivious to the surrounding turmoil, drunken men playing crap games in the middle of the street completely blocked it. The infection of vandalism spread rapidly, and the main concentration of downtown retail shops and department stores farther down Washington Street, the main business thoroughfare, fell victim to the mob. The large department stores such as Fellini's, Jordan Marsh, and R.H. White's were spared only because scores of armed watchmen stood at the entrances. Instead, two or three dozen smaller shops of all types received the crowd's attention. Men laden with shirts, neckties, jewelry brazenly walked along Washington Street, openly trading their loot. 15 of the shoe stores along the route were completely pillaged. Plunderers helped each other to find pairs of the proper size. Robbers sat calmly on the curb trying them on. The crowd moved rapidly from store to store on both sides of the street, and few establishments were spared. The broken show window glass was inch deep in places. From time to time, a small roving unit of police, inspectors, and officers sped up in a truck or a car, fired a few shots in the air, and succeeded in scattering the turbulent crowd. The rioters would run down to the side streets, only to gather again in strength on Washington Street a few minutes later. You see, that's where they make their big mistake. The cops shot in the air. You know, when you got a mob situation, a big, big mob situation and looting, you've got no other alternative than to kill them. Shoot them, at least. The Washington Street mob streamed past the Adams house where Governor Coolidge was sleeping peacefully on the upper floor. Like many other Bostonians, he was to read of the disturbances in the morning papers. Of course, Coolidge, you know, became president later. A part of the emboldened crowd had already turned on the side streets, continuing to loot the stores as they moved towards Tremont Street. The stores on this street opposite the Common were among the most exclusive in Boston. Many a poor Boston woman of limited means was later clothed in expensive dresses, furs, hats, and jewels from these stores. Boston Common was the pride of the city, but now, under the lights along the mall, which ran the full length of its east side, scores of crap games were in progress. Knots of men shot dice without interference, and many a player was relieved of his winnings by waiting thugs as he left the game. Boston had never been such boldly in display of lawlessness, such open defiance of its statutes as of this Tuesday night. For more than 2 hours, the downtown area seethed with robbery and looting. The few available police units were almost completely ineffective against the widespread destruction. Got to remember this, because this is what happens, and you have to be prepared for it to protect your family and your friends, or protect your block, you know, protect your neighborhood. At midnight, the provost guard was summoned from the Charleston Navy Yard across the bay to support the police. At 1 o'clock on Wednesday morning, the police asked the Edison Company to keep all streetlights burning until daylight. Scenes of even greater violence were being simultaneously played out in South Boston, a slum area near the busy waterfront, and you know that was black. Its citizens lived in shabby tenements, hovels, flats, cheap hotels, and boarding houses. The section was the gathering place for dock workers, stevedores, low-paid laborers, black, petty and hardened criminal thieves and pickpockets and gamblers. Hundreds of bars and saloons lined the street. The principal thoroughfare was West Broadway, the long blocks of which intersected by six main streets alphabetically labeled from A to F, with Dorchester Avenue at one end and Dorchester Street at the other. On Tuesday evening, only 20 men were on duty at one of the two police stations. The other was manned by a few officers and Metropolitan Park Police. Trouble began when a throng of about 1,500 gathered at the D Street station, waiting for the men to leave their posts at 5:45 p.m. Within an hour, the mob had increased to 5,000. A mob had gathered in full strength at the entire length of West Broadway from B to Dorchester Streets. 10 available non-striking patrolmen spaced themselves at intervals along the curbstones near D Street, where the largest numbers had gathered. Trouble immediately broke out on both sides of the little company of impotent policemen, and rowdies began cutting a swath along several blocks of West Broadway, smashing the windows of more than 24 stores and running off with the contents. Markets, haberdasheries, variety, and shoe stores were completely cleaned out. This was like the Watts riots. All this was within a block on each side of the police, who could not penetrate the barriers formed by the mob. Scores of plate glass windows were broken. The sidewalks and streets were soon carpeted with fragments of shattered glass. Though shop owners fired revolvers over the heads of the crowd, the depredation continued. Well, they shouldn't have fired over their head. They should have fired into the crowd. At two huge markets, the leaders of the robbers handed out eggs by the crate. Rowdies enjoyed a free-for-all, pelting everyone in sight. The superintendent of police arrived from downtown Boston with a few patrolmen and brought an end to the disturbance. By 11 o'clock, West Broadway and its intersecting streets were black with noisy, tumultuous crowd, which had increased to 8,000, all actively looting. A few available police formed at intervals along Broadway, but could not make headway against the milling, shouting, hooting rabble who pelted them with refuse, mud, and rocks. Got to remember, this is right after the First World War. Stores in two entire blocks along West Broadway suddenly became objects of attack. A Woolworth 5 and 10 cent store, 6 shoe stores, a dozen dry goods and clothing stores, tailor shop, 4 groceries, 3 bakeries, and saloons and liquor stores. There was enough for everybody. No one waited to make a selection but snatched the first items within reach. On Dorchester Avenue to the southwest, a similar reign of terror was taking place. A crowd of several thousand filled the street from curb to curb, overflowing into the streets. Now, you got to remember, this is not just blacks. This is mostly whites. Looting of stores along the avenue began. With bricks and paving blocks, the robbers attacked a few policemen sent to quell the disturbance. But the officers, their revolvers in one hand and clubs in another, walked fearlessly into the crowd. This surprising show of force cowed the drunken and savage mob. That's what I tell you, if you got the balls, you can stop a riot. in the face of a continued opposition, the outnumbered regular and volunteer police in South Boston could only discharge their revolvers and hurry back to the security of the station house. Whole sections of South Boston were completely devastated as if a tornado had struck. The rioters were in full and undisputed possession. For 2 or 3 hours they robbed with little interference. Only a few scattered outbreaks erupted in other sections of the city. Peace and quiet had prevailed throughout the greater part of Boston. As if on signal, early Wednesday morning, the uprising gradually ceased. The night of violence was at last at an end. Citizens read the headlines in the Wednesday morning's newspaper with both disbelief and horror. The head of the policemen's union stoutly maintained that the responsibility for the evening's rioting and looting rested with the Commissioner Curtis, not with the striking policeman. That advance notice of the walkout had been given to the public, had been told that an emergency force was available. Tuesday night's destruction served notice that the mob would only wait until darkness to reassemble. The city was feverish with activity and suspense. The mayor forbade the sale of firearms. School storekeepers boarded up their show windows, often stringing barbed wire along the entrances. Mayor Peters began to act late on Wednesday morning. He called out the State Guard units stationed in the city, totaling 1,000, and ordered them to be ready for service at 5 o'clock. Then he took command of the police department and asked Governor Coolidge for an additional 3,000 guardsmen. By darkness, the city was an armed camp. The metropolis was ablaze on Wednesday night. Steel helmet guardsmen were being rushed everywhere throughout the city. Armed watchmen were in most buildings and stores. The volunteer police were assigned to major spots where trouble might again be anticipated. Cavalry units of the State Guard now patrolled Scully Square, riding their horses on the sidewalks and forcing the crowd to keep moving. This crowd of 5,000 refused to disperse. Early in the evening, pistol shots rang out and the horsemen made a bayonet charge, driving the mob into the side streets. The crowd stampeded like cattle. Men and women attempting to escape fell over each other, trampling those who had stumbled and fell. Those on the sidewalks were pushed against the glass store windows, which shattered at the pressure, cutting many. Shots whistled through the air. Men on roofs hurled rocks upon the cavalrymen, and the crowds filled the narrow streets. When a man in the throng fell dead from a shot fired from above, the mob seemed momentarily sobered. But by 9 o'clock, Scully Square was again packed solidly with human beings. The rioters set up a barrage of bottles, mud, paving stones, and brickbats. Missiles rained from the rooftops. Infantry reinforcements finally charged the throng with drawn bayonets, clearing the square and posting sentinels along the cross streets. Remnants of the mob now surged through the side streets, repeating the attacks of Tuesday night on stores, more than 40 of which had been completely sacked. The soldiers broke up dice games in Avery Street and again on the Common. By midnight, guardsmen were stationed at intervals of 20 feet on both sides of Washington Street. Downtown Boston was under control. South Boston had erupted again on Wednesday night. A crowd of 5,000 gathered along West Parkway, doubling within an hour to 10,000, the largest of any of the strike. This mob decided to test its strength against a show of opposition. Armed gangs went on the rampage. Another dozen stores were broken into and wiped out in a well-established pattern. By 10 o'clock, the crowd, now considerably decreasing in numbers, became bolder. Enraged by the soldiers' rifles and bare bayonets on the street, some of the more daring took place in windows on the upper floors and began shooting at the perfect targets presented by the soldiers standing at attention below. The moment of decision came towards midnight. The guardsmen poured volley after volley of gunfire directly into the packed crowd, which scattered in all directions. When the smoke cleared, two men were dead and nine persons, six men and three women, lay seriously injured in the street. A third man died later, but control was established. Stores were still being robbed in other parts of Boston. Hundreds of holdups were reported, but order had been restored by early Thursday morning. The riot had now received national attention. In an address at Helena, Montana, President Woodrow Wilson said a strike of policemen in a great city, leaving that city at the mercy of thugs, is a crime against civilization. Fresh troops with fixed bayonets, ammunition in their belts, and rifles immediately established the power of law and order. Schooley Square in South Boston were now fully protected. When the dice games began again on the common, the soldiers shot directly at the players, killing one. 40 men were arrested. Governor Coolidge was forced to take a belated action on Thursday morning. He called out the state guard units from other parts of Massachusetts to maintain order. Commissioner Curtis declared the posts of all striking patrolmen vacant, thus dismissing them, and began rebuilding his force. He now belatedly considered the complaints of the ex-patrolmen and planned to introduce changes. You see, after enough violence, then they decided to make a deal. Again, violence was the answer. When President Samuel Gompers of the American Federation of Labor urged that they be reinstated, Coolidge made the 14-word statement that brought him national prominence and eventually led him to the White House. Quote, "There is no right to strike against the public safety by anybody, anytime, anywhere." Of course there's no right. If you want to do it, you just do it. Fuck the right. During the uprising, nine rioters had been killed and 58 wounded, 23 seriously. At its peak strength, guard units numbered 7,500 were on duty in the city, and the last did not leave until just before Christmas. The mob violence during the Boston police strike was unique among American riots. The riot had no particular sympathy with the strikers. They simply took advantage of the situation to indulge in extensive robbery, looting, and destruction. Never before or since has a mob been given the opportunity to take over a large American city which lacked police protection. Well, during the so-called Civil Rights Riot, several cities almost went down to the mob. As of 1962, 11 states had no strike laws applied to public employees. Action forbidding United States civil service employees to strike was taken by the 84th Congress in 1955. Public Law 330, U.S. Code Section 118 PR 1958, makes it a felony punishable by up to a fine of $1,000 and a year and a day in jail for federal employees who strike or assert the right to strike or knowingly belong to any organization that does. Well, you see, that's how the ruling class protects their goodies. That's how they protect their goodies. They pass all these laws, no strike laws. Well, so the working class finds out sooner or later that if they want it, they're going to have to just take it in hand and do it. And then there's excesses. Of course there's excesses. But if the city of Boston would have done right and paid their cops the right amount of salary and better conditions and fixed up their stations and all that kind of stuff, they would have avoided tens of thousands, probably several million dollars in damages. So they're stupid. You know, if a worker deserves a wage, more wages, give it to him. Because in the end, it's going to cost you more than that. But you see, the ruling class will never budge an inch. They'll never budge an inch unless they're threatened with losing their goodies. That's what I've always said. Don't go after people. Go after people's goodies. That's it for now. I'll see you tomorrow.
Towers crumble down and they drown in the blood, sweat, and tears.